You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. Up next, JX senior producer Natalie Golay offers a collection of short news features from around our region.
I'm Natalie Golay. Fishers used to be widespread across the Pacific Northwest. The small carnivores were eliminated from everywhere but California and a small sliver of southern Oregon. Jefferson Public Radio's Roman Battaglia reports, scientists are trying to figure out if bobcats or other species are stopping their return to more areas.
High up in the forests of the Siskiyou Crest in southern Oregon, Kiefer Titus is on the hunt for bobcats.
So that's one of our bobcat box traps. Have you ever had cats?
Yeah.
So you know if you put like an empty soda box on the ground or whatever, they just want to go in. They like little hidey holes. Bobcats are no different.
Titus is a wildlife research supervisor with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. His team is trapping these bobcats so they can help another local carnivore, the fisher. Fishers, not named for any fishing skills, are small, long mammals in the same family as weasels and badgers. They're also one of the only animals that successfully hunt porcupines. They used to be found throughout most of North America, but Titus says that efforts to remove other predators left fishers in the crossfire.
When people started coming out west, they were trying to get rid of wolves, grizzlies, cougars, so they were doing a lot of poisoning and things like that, and fisher are, you know, just a consequence of that.
Fishers were also sought after for their pelts. They were eliminated from much of the Pacific Northwest, including in Oregon. Over time, these small mustelids have recovered in this small part of southern Oregon, but they haven't expanded much further. This is the mystery Titus and his team are trying to solve.
Okay, any captures?
Yes.
Fisher?
Cat.
You're kidding me.
This is only their fourth bobcat capture this season. The team sets up a mini operation room inside a tent for the 21-pound cat. They don Kevlar gloves and, restraining the cat with long poles, sedate him. While they wait for the cat to go to sleep, Oregon State researcher Jesselyn Ayers prepares the collar that's used to track the animal's location. It comes with a standard GPS device, which logs the location 3 times a day and then sends the data to a satellite at night. It also has a little circuit board called a daily diary.
It's a triaxial magnetometer, accelerometer, pressure sensor. So it doesn't take a lot of battery, and we can take data 40 times a second.
This daily diary is so precise, Titus says they can tell when an animal is eating or even when it's shivering from the cold. Once the collar is prepared, it's time to put it on the cat. As rain and melting snow batter their small operating room, Ayers cuts off parts of the foam to get the collar around its neck. They're also monitoring vital signs and doing a physical exam.
Right mandibular and left mandibular are broken.
That means a few broken teeth, which is pretty common for wild animals. This isn't their first go-around. Titus says before collaring bobcats, they started with gray foxes, believing they might be attacking fishers. But the data said otherwise.
Fishers are more active a lot of times during the day. Foxes are a lot more nocturnal, and they generally prefer different habitats.
So now the research has moved on to bobcats. Surprisingly, Titus says they found fewer bobcats than originally expected. That could explain why fishers have thrived here, but haven't expanded further into Oregon.
It might just be like this situation, where it's like they can't expand because as they move forward, they're getting into those areas with more bobcats.
He says it's likely a combination of predation from bobcats, habitat loss, and human disturbances. The daily diary trackers should help them figure that out. This is the first time these have ever been used on bobcats or fishers. What they gather will help Ayers determine how the two species interact, if they do at all.
What I'm hoping to do is match behaviors to the landscape, like see what kind of habitats they're hunting in versus like just traveling through. Like they're not using the space, they're just going through it versus where they're resting.
Ayers plans to use the data to essentially create a 3D map of the animal's day, which will paint a picture of how these species share the land. The team plans at least one more season of trapping and collaring next winter. This information will help inform future forest management plans to ensure these little carnivores can thrive. After they're done securing the collar, the bobcat is laid in a crate inside the cabin of the truck, where the heat is put on blast to help him warm up from the cold.
Like, what in the hell just happened?
The bobcat is set free, back to his home where he'll become the latest participant in a mystery-solving science project. Roman Battaglia, JPR News.
Here in the Pacific Northwest, we're due for the Cascadia Megathrust earthquake. And when any large earthquake hits, one of the major concerns is a phenomenon called soil liquefaction. That's when ground shaking causes the soil beneath our feet to turn into a soupy liquid mess. Now a research team from Portland State University is working on a way to stop liquefaction before it happens. OPB Science reporter Jess Burns reports.
There's a small tent in an engineering lab at Portland State University, the heavy-duty type used to store things outside.
This is what I call the magic tent, where all the chemistry and all the reactions are happening.
PhD student Fadzai Svanai steps inside the magic tent with a bucket full of deep blue liquid. She places it beside a clear, chest-high tank filled with layers of white sand and silty gray-brown soil.
This silt layer is the one which is most common here in Oregon, Portland.
Svanai drops a hose into the bucket and starts a pump that will simulate in the tank what they want to happen underground. The liquid is a mix of nutrients, soil microbes, and blue food coloring to make the solution easier to track as it seeps through the sediment layers. That's where the real magic happens. When the liquid is in the soil, the tiny, hungry soil microbes will gobble up the nutrients and produce nitrogen gas.
So when you think about those microbes and what they're doing, are they burping or are they farting?
I think they're doing both burping and farting, yeah.
However you look at it, these microbes are key allies in an innovative new technique to prevent damage to buildings during major earthquakes. They'll guard against a phenomenon called soil liquefaction.
If you think back to the 70s and 80s kind of B movies of quicksand, that's what we're talking about in terms of liquefaction.
Kayla Sorensen is a PhD candidate at Portland State. In these movies, the hero would unwittingly run into a pit of quicksand and get sucked in.
Can you imagine how a building would react if the ground underneath it suddenly turned into this substance?
Basically, it would tilt or sink. Liquefaction can happen when vibrations from an earthquake hit soil that's fully saturated with water. These saturated soils are most often found along rivers and waterways, where the water table is high. That's also where many cities are built. Diane Moog is a geotechnical engineer working on the project.
Here in Portland, we have a lot of structures in Oregon that were built before we had a real understanding of the seismic risk in the area.
One of the most concerning spots is the critical energy infrastructure hub in Portland.
It's where 90% of Oregon's fuel is stored or handled.
These so-called tank farms along the Willamette River are built on high-risk liquefiable soils. The state is taking steps to bring the tanks up to seismic standards. But if the Cascadia earthquake hits before that's done, emergency officials are expecting chemical leaks, fires, and a devastating disruption to fuel supplies. Again, Kayla Sorensen.
The one thing that we're really fighting against is time, because it is not a matter of if it will happen, it is a matter of when it will happen.
The team's microbe-based solution to prevent soil liquefaction relies on being able to decrease the amount of water in the soil, says project engineer Arash Khosrowshahr.
The idea is that for the soils to liquefy, you need to have 100% saturation. This method works by reducing that saturation ratio from 100% down to whatever level required for it not to be liquefiable.
So picture it. You have a building on liquefiable soil. You drill two shallow wells, one on either side, says Moog.
You inject the treatment on one side of the infrastructure and then do some extraction on the other side. You can induce that treatment solution to flow underneath the structure and react to the soils underneath.
The microbes that naturally live in the soil feast and produce tiny air bubbles that push the water out from between the grains of soil. Displace enough water, and voila, no liquefaction, no matter how big the earthquake. In a field test, Khosrowshahr says those burping microbes reduce the soil saturation readings considerably, below 95%.
About 2 weeks into the treatment, they dropped down and they stayed down for like 5 years.
Then they were able to retreat the site in 2025 to similar result, but their testing continues.
This method, if it works, with a big if, but if it does work, then it would have a real impact.
Because there's no lack of buildings in the Pacific Northwest that could use some shoring up before the next major earthquake hits. I'm Jess Burns, reporting.
Have you ever listened to music and pictured shapes or colors in your mind? A local pianist and composer says that connection between sound and image can help musicians and listeners relate to music in a deeper way. KLCC's Kendra Schertel has more.
Alexander Schwarzkopf sits at his piano in his home studio in Eugene. The walls are covered with artwork. On one side, a large mural of an abstract geometric piano immediately draws the eye. Schwarzkopf describes it as the full spectrum of possibility realized.
You know, there's just this thing with realism and depicting objects and depicting things. I'm not interested in it. And I'm pulling between these two worlds. My fascination with geometric shapes, it's been a lifelong love, and I've always loved the work of the cubists and the expressionists.
Influenced by his artistic parents, Schwarzkopf's passion for the piano led him to graduate school, where he focused his research on something called structural interpretation. So, what does that mean? On the page, music looks linear. Notes move from left to right, just like you're reading a book. But Schwarzkopf studies the physical movement, tone, pitch, and clusters of sound to uncover what he sees as the internal architecture of a piece.
Taking your hands away from the keyboard, experiencing the sound, visualizing it. What is the shape? What does it look like? Is it jagged? What kind of an expression does that suggest to you? I think that you can get a lot from attaching these multiple associations.
In 2022, Schwarzkopf was invited to compose for Portland's Macrocosmos Festival in honor of the late composer George Crumb. One of Crumb's best-known works, Macrocosmos, includes a piece called The Magic Circle of Infinity. Instead of traditional sheet music, it's written in a circle. In homage to Crumb, Schwarzkopf also designed a non-linear score to accompany his piece, Synergy.
I was composing the piece for at least a week or two before I even found the shape of the form I was using. And at one point in the composing process, I thought, I need to stop because I actually don't know what this is going to look like.
Inspired by the infinity symbol, he sketched a lily with 8 petals arranged in interlocking loops. When he placed the musical notes inside the design, everything fit perfectly.
There are things on this image that are certainly, they're derived from notation aspects, like these big beams around the sides. Those are actually beams on groups of sounds. And so some of them are actually slurs that connect other groups of sounds, but so they form a kind of way it looks.
Not all of Schwarzkopf's art uses musical notation directly. Some pieces are more abstract, using color and geometric shapes that almost resemble graphic scores. What sets his work apart from that modernist tradition is that the images don't replace the notes. Instead, they reveal the visual structure inside the sound. Of course, there isn't an exact formula for how art and music come together.
It all stems from seeing or hearing and responding. And it's rearranging and restructuring those pitches into textures, forms, and then what timbre, what kind of color, what depth, what density is it? Is it opaque? Does it need to have a little light coming through it? That tells you about your touch. That tells you about the kind of sounds. Are they high? Are they low? Are they this or that?
Over the years, Schwarzkopf has performed all over the world, producing and participating in experimental concerts, playing with 6 pianists at once, projecting his artwork while performing, and even giving concerts in complete darkness. After one performance, an audience member told him something that stuck with him.
Never has anybody said so clearly to me, I could see the sound. And that was when I know for sure that this exists in everyone.
For Schwarzkopf, studying music this way changes how it's played. Instead of focusing only on notes and rhythm, he encourages musicians and listeners to think beyond and deepen their connection to the story within.
To physically actually draw a color and commit a color to the page causes you to actually feel and think and go beyond your rational mind. No matter the level that you're at, I think that you can get a lot from attaching these multiple associations.
Back in his studio, surrounded by art and a mural of possibility, the boundary between sound and image begins to blur. And if you step into that realm of creativity and imagination, you might start to see it too. I'm Kendra Chertel in Eugene.